28:42. Hear now the word of our Lord. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Here ends the reading of God's holy word. Well, we've probably come to one of the more twisted or misinterpreted passages in the Sermon on the Mount. This particular passage that has to do with the law of retaliation. This one generally is viewed as the section in the New Testament that clearly does away with, or appears to do away with, some of the more primitive, as we should say, or harsh aspects of the Old Testament law. An eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth, by many people is viewed as primitive, overextending justice to the point of being oppressive. So it is understood that what Jesus is doing here is he is abolishing it. He seems to be swiping away this aspect of the Old Testament. In fact, many people appeal to this particular section to justify pacifism. The aspect of remaining passive in light of oppression and evil being pursued against one. The argument is that Jesus' statements here are very categorical. They're very clear. There's no mistaking. He's telling us not to defend ourselves, not to avail ourselves of the court system. As Christians, we must, as he says earlier on in the sermon, be able and willing to undergo persecution. In fact, the argument is this only seems to bring out what Jesus says about blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And this exactly is the outfolding of that. Rather than be vindictive and insist on our rights and justice, we are to forego. And we are not to resist an evil person, as Jesus so clearly says in verse 39. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. And whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. We are to be overextended to physical harm. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, if people want to rob you of your possessions, we are not to build kingdoms in this world. Do not put your trust and hope in the riches that you acquire in this life, where robbers will take away. Jesus says the very same thing later on in the sermon. But we are to seek the kingdom of heaven first. And so, if people want to take your possessions, c'est la vie. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with them too. If people are going to take advantage of you, then you should be disposed to that. And let someone take advantage of you. Give to him who asks from you. And him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. This is the New Testament ethic that replaces the Old Testament. Well, we want to look at that. And as you know, I've been going through this and I've been arguing very vigorously that because of what Jesus says in verses 17, 18, 19, and 20, those are the foundational verses, as it were, that whatever he says there, he can't later on contradict it. And that Jesus, what he's doing is he's proving his point, really, through these case studies. He's proving that, A, he hasn't come to taught something different. And he's coming to show how the Pharisees have taught something different from what the law really taught to begin with. And so we need to understand that whatever we read here, regardless of how clear it may seem, it can't be seen out of the broad, immediate context of this chapter. You can't cut it out and say suddenly, out of nowhere, Jesus now takes a left turn, as the pacifists who are left want to. He doesn't just suddenly take this bizarre turn in his sermon. This is again proof of how the Pharisees had perverted the Old Testament law. So we want to look at is, again, the Pharisaical distortions. And then, secondly, how Jesus corrects them. And then finally, again, we want to ask that pertinent question, has Jesus really added something new to the New Testament? You notice I've been going through that pattern with all of these, just to drive home that point for you, because in your discussions with other Christians, fellow brothers, the pervasive ethic today, the pervasive mind view of Christian ethic is that Jesus has done away with the law. And often appeals made to the Sermon on the Mount, but that's, of course, if they misunderstand and twist the meaning of words, just as the Pharisees had done to the law. Well then, let's take a look at the Pharisaical distortions of the law. Jesus says, "You heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Now that is true. The law says that. And the rabbinical oral tradition has correctly interpreted, or at least correctly enunciated the law. You'll see that, remember, in the other examples, they had not even truly referenced the Old Testament law, stated it, as it were, in the law itself. This is traditionally known as the lex talionis. That's a Latin phrase for the law of retaliation, or the law of justice. But actually, talionis means to retaliate. The law of retaliation. And justice is a form of retaliation. And so this is about the law of retaliation. It's based on three Old Testament texts. Exodus 21, verse 22. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, if no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him. And he shall pay as the judges determine. This husband is not working outside of the law. He's working in conjunction with the law. But the law of retaliation established, and I'll deal with this a bit more detail this afternoon, that in retaliation, the victim must be considered first. It's a radical biblical concept. A radical meaning a basic biblical concept, something that our justice system doesn't appreciate. Notice again. If he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. This is something that's worked out between the victim and the court system. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. The law of retaliation. Leviticus 24, verse 17. Whoever kills any man shall surely be put to death. Whoever kills an animal shall make it good. Animal for animal. If a man causes disfigurement to his neighbor, as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Just think of the sports world and all the disfigurement that takes place in sports. Fracture for fracture. Eye for eye. Tooth for tooth. Those of you who like hockey, think of hockey. As he has caused disfigurement of a man, so shall it be done to him. Deuteronomy 19, verse 21. Your eye shall not pity, but life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. This is the law of retaliation. And this is obviously viewed by many people today, and it's not an overstatement to say it, as barbaric. Barbaric. But that's only because we are so ignorant of the law's intent. We are so ignorant of who ultimately is the judge and the victim in all these circumstances. Man represents God as his image bearer. And so whenever a man as a victim is hurt or harmed, it is a slight against God. We tend to forget that. Anyways, this is what is known as the law of retaliation, and the rabbinical tradition rightly enunciated it. However, we need to understand a few things about this law of retaliation. First of all, we need to understand that This law of justice, retaliation, is instituted by God through lawful authority. It's not something that we can take upon ourselves as an individual and exact from someone. The ultimate justice, of course, awaits God's verdict in the end day. But that doesn't preclude temporal justice, because God has established the authorities, appointed judges, to exact temporal justice. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15, we read, "One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests, and the judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry." Judges need to carefully inquire. "And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you." There is a deterrent aspect to justice. It's not the primary reason that we exact retaliation, but there's a deterrent here. "Nevertheless, your eye shall not pity, but life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." The point here is the Israelites were not allowed to exact justice on their own. And there is a misapprehension or a misunderstanding by many scholars today. You should be familiar with the avenger of blood. In the Old Testament, if someone slew your relative, there was a provision in the Old Testament law that allowed for someone in the family to avenge the blood of a slain relative. But you see, that wasn't done as a vigilante structure. That wasn't imposed by God as some means for which an individual can go out and exact vengeance on his own outside of the legal ramifications of Israel's court system. It was done in conjunction with the law of the land. The difference is they didn't have hired policemen. They didn't have hired marshals the way we have today to go out and find the perpetrators. It was really up to the family to go do the investigation and get the guy. But it was done in conjunction with the judges. And too many people read into that thinking, "Oh, well, you know, that guy down the road killed my brother. I'm going to go and I'm going to get him." And in the Old Testament, you were allowed to just avenge yourself for whatever and it was all right. No, it was done in conjunction with the elders and the judges. And as this passage says and makes clear, defining for us who a legitimate witness is to be, but the judges were to make due inquiry into the matter, that they might pass judgment. The person who enforced their judgment, of course, were the congregation of Israel themselves, the family members. So we need to be very careful. We have a tendency of reading into this things that are not there because we're so ignorant of their culture. Remember, they didn't have a police force as we have, a paid professional force of people who went around enforcing the laws. The Israeli society was really about self-government, families governing themselves and being lawful citizens. And they did have the court system and they did have a king. But it wasn't as structured as it is today. We usually are very ignorant of that. So the Israelites could not take the law into their own hands, though they enforced the law at the end after the judgment of the judge. It was always done in conjunction with an appointed magistrate. Now, God institutes this law of retaliation. He does it through appointed judges. Let me say two things about the law of retaliation before we actually look at the pharisaical distortions. One thing you need to realize is that This law was given to limit the wantonness of men. What do I mean by that? Men have a tendency of wanting to get even and then some. Still today, we have that phenomenon. We aren't interested in justice. We're interested in vengeance. And we are vindictive by nature because of our sinfulness. And so what this law did was it limited the extent of someone's wrath that could be imposed. The judge would ensure that. So punishment, you see, always had to fit the crime. It always had to fit the crime. It couldn't be excessive. Now, I know that our liberal culture views life for life as excessive, but that's because they're so perverted in their outlook on what life is and what makes life sacred. Our culture doesn't care about life at all. We know that because of the way they abort innocent children in the womb. Our culture is not concerned about life. All culture is based on irresponsibility. The reality is our culture cares nothing for life. But nonetheless, our culture, because it is so perverse, views this idea of a life for life as barbaric and over-excessive. And yet, God, who is the administrator and author of justice, says no. Justice is a punishment that suits the nature and extent of a crime. And if the punishment doesn't suit the crime, if it's either too excessive, or if it is not equal to, then it's not justice. Justice can't be so severe that it goes beyond the nature of the crime, because then it becomes worse than the crime itself. Example, in some Oriental societies, if a man killed someone else, then the avenger of blood in that family would not only get back the guy that murdered, but he'd wipe out the entire tribe. That was justice to them. But that's not justice. That's hatred, that's wrath, that's vindictiveness. In our culture, it's the opposite. Someone gets murdered, and we do nothing about it. We are unwilling to establish justice. You see, neither can it be so lacking that it has no merit. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 15 says, "He who justifies the wicked and condemns the just, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord." Both of them are an abomination. The barbaric actions of the Roman society or of ancient Oriental societies was barbaric and unjust to God. But our liberal Western societies are just as much an abomination. Every murderer that gets off without having to pay for his murder with his life has been justified, even if he's locked up behind bars. Our society is saying we're unwilling to impose biblical justice. We're holier than God. To God, these things are an abomination. So you see, the law of retaliation limited and defined biblical justice. And the point of limiting was to limit men's vengefulness, but also to establish very clearly that if you're going to have justice, then your punishment must suit crime. Life for life, eye for eye, foot for foot, fracture for fracture, wound for wound, tooth for tooth. This is just to give you a preliminary understanding of the law of retaliation. I'm going to deal with it much more detailed this afternoon. Now let's take a look at the Pharisaical distortions. As I already established, the Pharisees, they quote the law correctly. That's not the problem. The problem is with the way they interpreted it. The problem is with the way they applied the law. You see, to them, retaliation, giving their culture of occupation now, since the Babylonian exile, most Jews had been occupied by foreign power. And as a result, in many cases, they were not able to institute these laws. They didn't have the authority. They were allowed to do some things, but in many cases, they couldn't impose their Jewish laws through the occupied court system, especially at the time that Jesus was there. We had a Roman governor. We had the Roman Pilate, who basically was the head over the justice system. They had their Sanhedrin, but they couldn't just impose any old law they wanted to. So as a result of this, and this is part of that climate, the rabbinical tradition basically pointed out this, that the law of retaliation isn't just a legal matter, but a personal matter as well. It's very important you understand that. Remember, law of retaliation isn't something that any Israelite could personally impose. But they're saying it is a personal matter. They recognized the need for due process. They understood the court system. That wasn't the issue. But you see, under the occupation, and because they couldn't impose true Jewish law, the Roman courts held power over them, held sway over them, justice, in many cases, became a personal matter. Because courts wouldn't always uphold the laws. You can understand that. It's totally no different than our climate today. The courts don't uphold law anymore, do they? You are a victim of a crime. Generally, you'll get nothing from the courts. And so, in similar circumstances under Roman occupation, that's what happened then. You go to court and you'd get no satisfaction. Retaliation became a personal thing. If you're going to get justice, the idea was you have to go and exact it yourself. You have to go and exact it. And so you see, they interpreted the law of retaliation, or they saw the law of retaliation as justifying personal vindictiveness. And that's what they taught. You have the right, according to the law, to go out and exact justice when someone crosses you. You are allowed to go out and exact justice. You know, wherever courts break down, whenever they don't uphold true law, you'll always see a rise of vigilantism. It's a natural outworking of that. We are made in the image of God, which means that we demand justice by the very nature of the case. When we're crossed, we will recognize it, and we want justice. When God is crossed, He knows it, and He wants justice. That's just a natural correlation. And when the court system becomes very liberal, as it is today, and where justice is not upheld, where justice is perverted, mitigated, reinterpreted, and where the victim is no longer the consideration of the courts, but rather the criminal and his rehabilitation becomes their utmost importance, and all the emphasis is on the criminal and his rights and how we can restore the criminal and make them feel better so that they don't do this again, and the victim is left with nothing, then don't be surprised when more and more people arm themselves. And more people begin to take the law into their own hands. Nor they don't wait for the police anymore. And they care nothing for the court system. And they eventually trample the very institutions that make a democracy what it is. Government, courts, police. We are well on that way. With every judgment that comes out of the court system, which just fuels liberalism, we are well on our way to absolute anarchy in our culture. It may be a way of God cleansing. It may not happen. I don't want to be a prophet here. But my point is, wherever the courts fall to pieces, vigilantism will always be on the rise. Where justice breaks down, where laws compromise, where a liberal view of justice perverts real justice, people will feel they have no alternative but to take the law into their own hands. And so the Pharisees, in a sense, taught that this law of retaliation, although it is a matter of the courts, is also a personal matter, and you may then go out and exact justice. A man has the right to exact justice over every personal slight, they taught. A personal insult, the pilfering of personal property, even if it's done through legal means, being taken advantage of, well beyond what you are willing to extend yourself, you may exact justice If you're crossed, don't trust the court system. This law of retaliation, and because of the stuff that we learn in the Old Testament about the relative who's allowed to avenge the blood, gives us justification for teaching that you may be vindictive. Now, they wouldn't have said it that way. They would have merely taught that this is a person who is establishing his right of self-defense. But you see, in essence, based on the way Jesus phrases it, it wasn't about justice. It became vindictiveness. They became petty. Every little issue became a matter of asserting their self-defense and their personal pride. They used this law to justify vengeful passions. They were vindictive. They wanted to get even and then some. That was really what was going on here. You see, with their mouth they said one thing, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. They quoted the law, but with their hearts and their actions they proved that they were vindictive people. They weren't interested in due process. They weren't interested in being patient under God's providence. God had placed them under Roman occupation because of their sinfulness, and that was what they would have to bear as a result until they repented and turned to God. They were unwilling to do that. They were unwilling to be patient for God. You know, God has placed many of us today under pagan occupation. It's not overtly clear in one sense because we have many freedoms. But I'm convinced more and more that we are under pagan occupation. And more as our culture goes down this slippery slope to liberalism and chaos, we as Christians are going to find ourselves in an absolute war with our culture, where we will get very little satisfaction from the court system because of the things we believe in, if you believe in them faithfully. And that's precisely when we need to be very careful we don't become like the Pharisees. We don't become vindictive. We're not patient for the Lord. We're not patient understanding that in many ways God is chastising us because we've turned our back on Him, just as He chastised the Old Testament Jews. The Pharisees used this law to justify vindictiveness. Well, that's how they had distorted it. It's not just a matter of due process, it's a personal matter. You can take the law into your own hands. That's really the way they taught it. Jesus comes to correct this distortion. Notice what He says. In light of this, I taught to resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Now let's address this apparent tone of pacifism. I mean, there's no disputing that it sounds that way, right? You read it, and the first thing that you're struck with is that God in Christ is saying to us, I want you to be a pacifist. I want you to forsake all form of self-defense and right. Right? Natural reading, you walk away, you can't get away from that. Well, let's address that. First of all, let's remember, Jesus is dealing here with, he's contrasting the hypocrite covenant child with a true covenant child. Remember, that's the antithesis of the sermon. It's between the real Christian and the fake Christian, not between the Christian and the world. He's contrasting different attitudes. He's contrasting two different views of the law. The Pharisaical, rabbinical view and interpretation of the law and the true interpretation of the law. That's what he's doing here. Okay? This is not a dissertation on the abolition of the legal structure that God instituted. I want to be very clear about that. Jesus doesn't talk at all about the court system and the abolition of justice in this passage. It's no different than when he dealt with divorce and its legitimate forms, right? He didn't talk about adultery and its legal and just recompense by the state, which would be capital punishment. He talked about the legitimate ground for divorce. Idolatry, licentiousness, all kinds of fornication and sexual perversion. That was what he dealt with. Here again, he's not dealing with the court system and its abolition. He's dealing with a proper attitude, one which is either vindictive or one that is Christ-like and meek. That's the contrast. Now, in light of that, he uses hyperbole to stress the point. Now, it's very clear in the context that Christ does not condemn, first of all, legitimate self-defense. It would be absolutely contradictory of Christ to condemn a father for defending his family from a thief or a robber that wants to break in and harm the family. It would be absolutely contradictory for Christ to condemn that, since Christ already said, I haven't come to abolish the law. And the law in Exodus chapter 22, verse 2 says that if a thief, not a murderer, a thief, many thieves are murderers, they kill in order to steal. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. That was part of the law that Jesus says, I've come to restore. Now, he's either come to restore this or he hasn't. And of course, the pacifist interpretation is that Jesus has done away with self-defense. But he already told us he didn't come to do away with that. He's not dealing with legitimate self-defense in this passage. He's dealing with the problem of vindictiveness. Moreover, let's be clear, that Christ is he's not condemning legitimate self-defense. He's also not condemning the court structure and the role of the state. It would be a complete revision of all Old Testament passages if we read by this and assume by this, as many pacifists have to assume, that really the court structure and the civil government is irrelevant in the Christian society. Paul quotes and says, Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but give wrath. Give rather, give place to wrath. For it is written, Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And then he says, right after that, in chapter 13, Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid. He does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. In chapter 12, at the end, he says, Brothers, don't avenge yourselves. Don't take the law into your own hands. Give place to wrath. Remember, vengeance is God's. How does God execute his vengeance on the earth? Through the legitimate structures. The state. This is why we need godly government. To ensure that the government will be just. But nevertheless, even ungodly government is instituted by God for the purpose of punishing evildoers. So Jesus doesn't deal with the state in this passage. He doesn't deal with the idea of self-defense. He's contrasting a vindictive attitude with a meek attitude. That's the first thing that we need to see. And obviously, to drive home the point, Christ uses hyperbole. As I said, the contrast, the antithesis is between the true covenant child and the hypocrite. And the point is this, we are not to become obsessed with every slight to our personal dignity. And it's easy to do that. It's easy for all of us to become obsessed with personal slights. To become enraged with every offense and slur against us. And so the contrast, you see, is between those who are motivated by a spirit of Christ-likeness, meekness, remember, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, and those that are vindictive and become petty. Now notice the three examples he gives. He says meekness regarding personal effrontery. First of all, he deals with personal insult. And you need to understand that in verse 39, he's dealing with an insult. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. Whatever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. This is hyperbole. He's dealing with a personal insult, a slap across the face. At that time, no less than today, was considered an insult. Now, there was certainly a sting to it. It smacked, it hurt, but it was considered a personal insult. He's not talking about a knockdown punch. A lot of people view the slap exactly that way. They see it as a knockdown, drag him out, kick him down, beat him up, punch. And that as God and Jesus is saying, now after you've been beaten up and knocked down and you've had a concussion, after you recover, get up and ask for it again. Is that what he's saying? No, he uses hyperbole to point out that if we are personally insulted, then live with it. Accept another insult. Don't immediately retaliate. Insult for insult. And we're all prone to doing that. Some of us more so than others. Very important. A lot of people really twist this up and consider the slap as though it were a punch. He's not asking you to open up yourself to be beaten up. Well, that may happen. And even then, we must probably exercise prudence and meekness. But he's not forbidding self-defense. He's talking about how Pharisees, immediately they were insulted, and if they were slapped, they would immediately want to exact vengeance and get back at the offender. Murray says this, we are not to suppose that he is inculcating passive non-resistance, and then when injured, we are to stand up and invite more. Murray is absolutely right. This is not what Jesus is doing. He's commanding us, for the sake of a Christ-like attitude, to be meek and not immediately retaliate personal insult for personal insult. And he uses the slap because that would be the most visible and the most stinging form of a personal insult in that culture. The insult that when you were slapped in the face, you would want to retaliate, but what right do you have to slap me in the face? We need to understand that. He's talking about a slap, not a beating. And Jesus says in verse 40, if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Jesus is speaking here of personal pilfering. Some guy, he begins to steal from you, little things. He exacts something from you, and he even uses the court, the legal court system to do that. Maybe over taxation, maybe whatever it is. But he's dealing with pilfering here, personal property, through the legal channel. And it happens all the time. And in our society, where there is so much wickedness, it's hard to avoid. People will rip you off all the time. And if you're a person who is always concerned about defending and exacting justice every time someone slights you, then you could make a career out of that and get nowhere in this life. And he's saying, look, when someone wants to rob you of something little, open yourself up for that reality. Perhaps give him more. Now, of course, the pastor says, see here, here's an example of Jesus doing away with the Old Testament. But the Old Testament says that we are, and we are in a sense commanded to defend that which God has given us. It is our sworn duty to defend our family and to keep an inheritance for our children's children. So there needs to be a balance between what Jesus says here and what the law of God clearly establishes. And again, Jesus is dealing with the attitude. He's not suggesting that self-defense is wrong. Finally, in verse 41, And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. He's clearly dealing with being taken advantage of. Now, you all heard about the fact that a Roman soldier could compel a Jew to walk a mile with him and carry his wares, obviously. That would be a form of being taken advantage of. Under this occupation, the Roman soldier had the authority to use a Jew. You will be used in this life. Usury, not only in terms of money, but in terms of your time, in terms of whatever, people will use you. People have already used us. Coming to our fellowship, we have loved them, we've lavished gifts on them, we've lavished friendship on them, and they've turned around and they have taken advantage of us. Little as it was, it's nothing big. That's life. Now, do we turn around and do we demand satisfaction? Do we become vindictive because someone has taken advantage of us? No. You see, again, meekness. Christ was taken advantage of all the time. He was very meek. Now, of course, he came for that express purpose. Christ's point, ultimately, is that we must learn to be meek. Not weak. Meek. Charitable. Forbearing. That's the attitude and the characteristic that he wants us to have. And so, you see, the law of retaliation doesn't do away with self-defense, doesn't do away with justice, but the law of retaliation does not encourage a vindictive, vengeful spirit, which is what the Pharisees were teaching. Don't always be concerned for personal justice. With every slight of personal insult, the pilfering of your property, which happens all the time, or being taken advantage of, don't immediately seek vengeance and retaliation for every little issue. Moreover, never take the law into your own hands. Jesus is doing is correcting the Pharisaical attitude that says, I'm going after everyone that crosses me, regardless how petty it is, and I'm not waiting for justice from the courts. I'm going to take it into my own hands. He's saying that the law of retaliation doesn't give us the right to personally enforce justice independent of God's legal established means, as the Pharisees had argued. And of course, let me reiterate, this is a far cry from him saying that we need to be doormats. He's telling us to be meek, not weak, forbearing, not patsies, charitable, because love covers a multitude of offenses, but not exacting. Patient for God's justice, not eager for temporal and personal retaliation. To let go of our ego and our pride when it is hurt because of an insult. However, he is not saying don't defend your life or your family when evil men want to kill you, your wife, your children, or destroy all your possessions. He's not saying that. It's not the issue. And pacifism, you see, ultimately becomes a great injustice. Because it set up a straw man argument here. It's looking into this passage and reading into this things that are just not there. It is an abandonment of our duty to love and defend and protect those whom God has placed under our care. That's what pacifism is. It is one of the most heinous, the most gross injustices being propagated as Christian love today. The idea that there is anything charitable and loving and forbearing of a father sitting back while his family is being massacred, or of a wife sitting back when it is within her means to do something to defend her family, is not Christian charity and love. We will stand before God one day and we'll have to give an account for how we have provided for, defended, cared for those God has placed providentially in our care. That includes our government. who are shepherds of the citizens of this country, who will have to give an account to God for every victim that they further traumatized when they did not exact justice. Pacifism is a gross evil. There's nothing Christian or charitable about it. And Jesus is not dealing with pacifism. He's dealing with the attitude of meekness in comparison to vindictiveness. Now let me ask us this question then. Has Christ added anything new when he says, don't avenge yourselves? When he says, I want you to be meek. I want you to be charitable. I want you to be forbearing and patient when you are personally insulted and when little trivial things happen in your life. There's the difference. Slight personal insults, a little bit of theft, little problems that happen in life that you can't avoid and you can't always get justice for, and it's ridiculous to think you could in this life. And to be motivated by vengefulness. When he says, no, be meek, be charitable, be forbearing, is he adding something new here? Well, remember, Christ does not abolish the role of state in its legitimate work. The point of Christ's word is to deal with one's attitude towards insults, petty crime, and usury. The point is not to abolish the legitimate function of justice and the magistrate. Therefore, in prescribing the necessity for meekness, patience, and charity, Christ is reiterating what the Old Testament always said. Christ says, don't take the law into your own hands. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18 says, and you shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. It says it right there. You are not allowed to just go take exact vengeance. That's the Old Testament law. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people for any wrong they may have done to you. Proverbs 24, verse 29 says, do not